The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Some question that's comma I can try to answer here.
So this thing?
Yeah.
How do you actually generate that chart from the equation?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So what is so let me starting from there. Matt is asking that energy solution from the equation. Can you actually generate that chart from the equation? So first, let's look at this solution. What it looks like is. Periodic over 2. This is a wave vector direction, and okay. So what is the equation? The equation. Tell me what's the equation? That's what we saw. P K A cosine. Let me write it down. Okay. K A sine K A plus cosine K A equals small cosine K A. That's a small k on the right hand side. And this K, capital K, is the energy. So what we relate to energy through H square. Well, I looked at it. I see my equation 3.24 has a H bar square missing. I'm sorry. Okay. Did you mark that down where I missed the H bar square? Okay, thanks. Matt is asking me whether I can generate this curve, which is the eigenvalue solution for energy, from that equation. And so you can take a look. This Ka, so K, this capital K is essentially my energy. Right, if I find this capital K, I find my energy through this relation here. And then I want to solve this equation, and of course I can take a capital K A as one variable. That's the left-hand side. This is a Y equals capital K A. And the right-hand side, this small K A is my X. So if I want to solve this equation, the case I looked at the right-hand side, I can first, what I showed in the book is a graphical solution. So in this graphical solution, we plot capital Ka, so the right-hand side, as a function, the whole right-hand side as a function of capital Ka, right? So you can see capital Ka, when Ka approaches zero, this ratio is 1, that's a P plus 1, right? Sine Ka or sine Y divided by Y should approach 1 in the limit of Y equal to 0, right? So I plotted, I first plot the right-hand side as a function of Ka, that will be P plus 1, that's somewhere here, and then it's a periodic function, but this period, because here I have this Ka increasing, so this term is decreasing periodically, right? So I have same on the, and eventually you can see when this goes to infinite, this one goes to 1, plus minus 1, that's the oscillation period. Amplitude. So that's my left hand side, right? And I, what I one is to solve for this equation for capital Ka. So the left hand side, the right hand side gives for each Ka value. I have value on the right hand side. And what I'm saying here is this value is between minus 1 and plus 1 because that's cosine function. This is the value on right hand side. Right? So what for every value of small Ka, I have maybe this value is here, but it's between minus 1 to plus 1. So given that value, I look at what capital Ka can satisfy that value. Right? So first observation is that in this region where this function is larger than plus 1 or smaller than minus 1, so in this region, there's no solution. Right? Because it's larger than the right-hand side, so no matter what, there's no solution. Okay? So there's no solution if you translate it corresponds to this region. Because this is a no solution for K means a no solution for E. So in those regions, there's no solution for the energy. Okay? And then for in between, if in this region I have solution here, right? This region I have solution. This region I have solution. Right? And but it really does not depend, say, because this function is a periodic, right? So every 2 pi, Ka equals every 2 pi, I have the same value. So I can plot Ka from minus infinite to plus infinite every 2 pi, I have the same solution for that energy. Right? So if for certain Ka, if this is the cosine Ka at this value, I find one solution, I find another solution here. That will be one point is here, the other point is here. Okay, right? You may have, say, first continue those so you can plot more bands. And you can see this gap, this small gap here, that's this region that there you don't have a solution. This region you don't have a solution for that capital K because there's no solution allowed in this region. That means no solution allowed for the energy. So you can continue plot until you can say eventually this is approaching 1. So there's always solution when you go to a very high band, right? So you approach the continuum energy. So that's what why we say this is a periodic. I'm sorry. Okay, so you can draw from every 2 pi. And then I made another argument in the book, in my lecture. I say this, I only care about this region. The symmetrically, here is a pi over A, and here minus pi, this is a plus pi over A, where A is the period of the potential. And first, we already say that at every 2 pi, I have the same solution. Right? So that means this section is the same as this section. Okay? So I don't really care about the region outside there. I can take any region, 2 pi, I can take it between here to here. But it's just to say more convenient, more unique, as this we have to go to section 1 as I'm going to talk later. This is a unique way to define what's the region that we should choose. Because you can choose any section of that 2 pi. Okay? So this is the way we representing the electronic energy. Typically, we don't plot many periods. We just plot this, because beyond that is the identical solution. And in fact, we don't even plot minus pi over a side, because this is a symmetric. So we only plot half of it in most of the case, with the understanding the other half is just a mirror image. Okay? So this is also where I want to start this lecture. So thanks for the question. I hope I clarify this. And if you remember how we get this, I said you basically start with a one-dimensional chain periodic potential. And in reality, the potential may be looking like this. But the... Right? That's because surrounding each atom, you have 1 over r potential drop. And the model, chronic panic model, is really making a square potential approximation. Although I did not go through the math, I hope that you have read the chapter and went through the math. It's basically solving the Schrodinger equation for this periodic potential, the chronic panic model. And in doing so, we have to introduce some periodic boundary condition utilizing the fact the potential itself is periodic. And that leads to the block theorem. That's what we use, which says because the potential is periodic, I have this wave function x plus whatever t, which is the period, several period of the lattice, then it's ikt cosine x. So this, with this periodic boundary condition, I translate the problem of solving the Schrodinger equation in the whole infinite period into just looking at any one period. So I can just look at this one period and solve the equation. Because this gives us effectively two more boundary conditions. And the other thing that I used to arrive at the value of that k, because this one here, we have not given the value of k, is the von Kármán periodic boundary condition. This is different from Bloch's theorem. Bloch's theorem explored the fact that because the potential is periodic, so the wave function must satisfy this relation. And von Kármán periodic boundary condition is really for the whole lattice, say, because usually the lattice is very big, the crystal is very big, has a lot of atoms in any specific direction. So what it says, well, the number 1 and the number n, the last point, really how we can specify this boundary condition for these two points. And the von Kármán approach is to say, let's just take these two points identical. So make the whole structure cyclic, rather than in reality we know it's not really cyclic from 1 to n. Right? And so this cyclic periodic boundary condition basically says x plus na. Na is the a is the lattice constant, and na is just the length in this direction. And just to say, let's make the whole structure periodic, cyclic. That's what the von Kármán boundary condition. And this is valid for big crystals, because at the end, the endpoints are not important. Okay? And this is where, when you go to nanostructures, you have to be careful. You cannot use this periodic boundary conditions, because you may just get a thin film, the thickness direction, there are only 10 atoms. It's a lot longer, like in bulk crystals, 10 to the 23rd atoms of Avogadro constant. That's the number, right? So in that case, the endpoints are not important, but in nanostructures, this is where often you have to deviate, avoid the use of von Kármán periodic boundary condition. So you can see with this periodic boundary condition, what we get is that IKNA equals 1, or that gives us N is 2 pi N and capital NA, or 2 pi N. Since capital NA is just the length of the crystal, so here is the length of the crystal. So we have discrete value of this V vector, small k, the V vector. And this N could be 0 plus minus 1 to infinite, an integer. And what it tells us is that corresponding to each N, there is a wave function for the electrons. So corresponding to each N, there is a wave function for this corresponding wave vector Kn. And each wave function, again, remember, since we're dealing with the electrons, each wave function can have two states, right? The electron can have spin up and spin down, which I cannot get from the Schrodinger equation. So I really have KNS. That's artificially I add the spin to the Schrodinger equation, to the wave function. So what it tells me, again, I come back to the allowable value of the wave vector. So from pi to a to minus pi to a to plus pi to a, there's a factor of 2 pi. One period is 2 pi. How many wave vector in this one period? How many small k allowed in this period? It's important to count. Capital N. So you look at it, right? From every 2 pi, this N, when you change from 1 to N, this change 2 pi. Right? Kn change 2 pi. When this small n change from 1 to N, you repeat 2 pi. Right? To 2N, you repeat 2 pi. That means inside this one period, really there are N wave vectors, N wave functions, right? That means 2N quantum mechanical states, because the S, I have spin up, spin down. So in one period, there are 2N quantum mechanical states in this one-dimensional periodic potential formed by atoms. Right? You all buy into that. That's important. You'll see why it's important. Yes?
How can the length be in the actual case?
How can the length come into the picture? Or what? How large is the crystal? Well, at the end, this N typically is not important when we talk about per unit based quantities. So this length is not important. If we talk about total heat capacity of the crystal, it's important. But if we talk about specific heat per unit volume, then it becomes eliminated. Okay. So what they say is, okay, this delta K is 2 pi divided by L, right? That's the length of the crystal. That's in one increment. And this is very small normally because L is large. So there are so many points in one curve. Again, in bulk crystal, you think about Avogadro number. That's the number of atoms, say in one more, right? So there are so many points here. So this curve is essentially quasi-continuous, right? Each of these bonds is quasi-continuous. It's a lot absolutely continuous, like we do in continuum mechanics, say in infinite divisible, because the k vector spacing is 2 pi divided by L. The spacing, it's just this space is small. Okay? And what this tells us is before we say one electron, if we just consider an isolated potential well, we say the wave function, this is a wave function of one electron. And now, after we solve the Kronig panel, say the electron wave function in this periodic potential, what we get is the waves as represented by this wave vector. The wave vector is 2 pi divided by lambda. Okay, you can think of this as the so each wave vector corresponding a wave, and this wave now because the crystal is no longer isolated. There is overlapping between the waves, and we see because of this overlapping, it's split. Originally, it's just an individual energy level. Now it's split into this quasi-continuous band, energy bands, and corresponding to each of this wave vector, there is more like a wave function that extends through the whole crystal. Right? So now this is the wave one function of one electron. So that means the electron belongs to the whole crystal. It doesn't belong to individual atom anymore. Okay? Right? So that's because in a periodic potential, due to this periodicity and the Pauli exclusion principle plus the quantum, say the Schrodinger equation leads to that conclusion. We have the electron really the wave function extending through the whole crystal. And with this as a basic, let's say, when you look at the book, you look at the crystal structure, you may feel, oh, this is very complicated. But if let's just hold this basic point. So we have so many wave vectors in one the period 2 pi, these are the number of allowable wave functions. And then we can go to use Pauli exclusion principle and understand a lot of things. And and this is the basis for us to understanding why we have metal, why we have semiconductor, why we have insulator. So let's, again, take one-dimensional example, okay? We have been talking about one-dimensional. And I have those atoms arranged in periodic fashion. And I know, so I have one atom and an N atom from 1 to N, right? And I now know that I have a wave function NS. Well, this n, the number is from 1 to n. I have n wave functions, and I have 2n quantum mechanical states. Right? So I have the general shape of this solution for energy. Is this is the energy bands. I only plot half of it. And this is the Lex band. And now I also know that there are, between here and here, 0 to pi over A, because I'm only plotting half of it. And remember this delta K, this is a K, the distance is 2 pi divided by L. So between 0 to pi over A, I would have how many? N divided by half points. Or if I do N S, if I count the spin, I will have N quantum state, capital N quantum mechanical state. So now, let me say, if each of these atoms has one electron, okay? Each of these atoms has one electron. How this electron will take the reverse quantum mechanical state? Okay, so if each atom one electron, so I would have n electrons, right? Total, and now the collective, communism, everything shared here. Okay, n electrons, and we have two n wave function states. Two n states for each bond, right? So here again, let me plot the both sides. So from pi minus pi over a to pi over a, I have 2n k wave vectors and 2n quantum mechanical states. So for each bond, I have a total of two n quantum mechanical states. So now I have one electron from each atom. Then I have two n electrons. So when I fill the quantum mechanical state, the lowest level is filled first, right? So let's see where the electron. Let's go to absolute zero temperature, so that there's no thermal energy to excite the electron to other states. So it always, when at absolute zero, it always is a, since it goes to the lowest energy states allowable. Okay, so here I would fill the lowest energy level that would take two electrons, right? And so I continue to fill, and where it will stop? Where is the topmost electron? Is it here or in the middle? It's n over 2, so it's somewhere is here, right? Okay? And this is important. So that means, this is the lowest energy, absolute zero. And since the topmost electron is here, so there is those are empty quantum mechanical states here. Those are all filled. So there are empty states in the upper level. So that means the electron at the long zero temperature can go to those empty states. Right? Because those states are very close. We said it's quasi-continuous, it's almost continuous. It's much smaller than KT. Okay? So the electron can move inside this quantum mechanical states. If there's no available states, it doesn't move, it's an insulator. Now it can move inside this band. This is a conductor. This is an electric conductor if it feels it not completely fill this band. Okay, in this one dimension, just fill half the band's problem, right? So this is a metal, in this case, one electron here. And this upper topmost energy level is called the Fermi level. So here is where Fermi level, okay? And this is referred to the uppermost energy level at the absolute zero temperature. And so this is the simple case when I have one electron, and now you go to two electrons. So if every atom there has two electrons, what happens? Where it fills? Huh? It continue to fill here, right? It fill to the top of the band. Then what happened? It want to move, because motion means you will change states. Okay? If you want to have electric conduction, you change the energy states. And so that would then depends on this gap. If this gap is small, at 300 Kelvin compared to room temperature energy 26 millielectron volts, right? If this gap is small, then you can go here. So those electrons there can move. But if the gap is large, right? So if the energy gap, so now this energy gap becomes very important. And if the gap is small, it can move. If the gap is large, it cannot. So we let's say EG is typically 3 electron volts as a demarcation line. And if this gap is larger than 3 electron volts, it's an insulator. Okay? And this is only, of course, there is a gap that whether it's an insulator really depends on whether the electron fell to the top of the bands, right? If it does not fall to the top of bands, it's metal. Okay. And but if it happened to fall in the top of bands at absolute zero temperature, then and if this gap is large, then at a higher temperature, there's no electron can move to here. That still is an insulator. Right? And if the band gap is not large, then at room temperature, there's some thermal energy. Thermal energy coming from the random motion of the atoms, right? Or random motion of the electrons. Or in this case, if the random motion is disallowed, because the electron, you see, you failed everything. But the atom, the lattice, will have enough energy to kick some electron from the lower to higher energy bands. So so we have two scenarios. One is an insulator, and the other is a semiconductor. So in the case of semiconductor, this gap, EG, is small. Let's say, since we define there is roughly 3 keV, less than 3 keV is a semiconductor. But typically, if it's less than 3 keV, you have to think about the Boltzmann factor is the energy divided by kBT exponential. That's the first chapter we gave, right? Roughly, what's the population, what's the probability of energy level being occupied? Now, kBT is 0.26 eV at the room temperature, 3 divided by 0.26 exponential minus. You can see it's a very small number. Right? So what happens is if it's a pure semiconductor, that means there's no other atoms impurities inside. It's and if the gap is reasonably large, 1 electron volts or 1.5 electron volts, even at room temperature, is still as an insulator. Okay? Because there's not enough electrons that are kicked from the lower band to the upper band. But say, yeah, let's suppose there are some electrons kicked. So here, I'm plotting only half. Let's suppose this is a E, this is a K. So here what I have is I kick a few electrons from this band to the higher band because of thermal energy. Then what's left are few empty states here. The electron in this band can still take advantage now of the empty state in the original field band. And then there are some free electrons in the upper band that can also move. Right? So here is a conduction band. And here is called the valence band. Yes?
Does the electron mean only free electron or all electrons each atom
have? Those are all electrons. Well, once you see an insulator, it fills in, it's no longer free. Okay? Yes?
About is so small that the first level energy levels is not filled.
The first level energy level, if this one is not filled, it's a metal.
Like if n is small enough such that the amount of possible electrons you have in the whole material only allows this, they all end up filling the bottom level.
The bottom here?
Yeah, then how can you tell the difference between metal and insulator?
Well, that depends on how many small electrons. How small is small, right? How you define whether you, if the electric conductivity is 10 to the minus 5, 6, how you define your insulator, where you define your demarcation between an insulator and a conductor. Here, I was saying, if in pure semiconductor, there may be only a very few electrons coming here. Very small probability. Then it's essentially an insulator even at room temperature. That depends on the gap. Okay? But if the gap is moderate, then you can have some electron, moderate number of electrons now come into this band and left some empty states, quantum mechanical states behind it. And now the situation is electrons in this band can conduct, and because there are additional empty states now available, so the electrons in this band can also conduct. Right?
So back here, when you had an insulator where the entire core band is full,
yes.
Aren't there
N
over 2 empty states in that lower band?
Well, n over 2, there are total of psi n quantum wave function, so there are 2n states, quantum mechanical states. So if you have n electron here, that's only fill half. If you have 2n electron, that fills the bottom, the top, fill the whole band.
So each atom in this case has two electrons.
Two electrons, right? If it's one electron, it fills half. If it's two electrons, it fills to the top. And remember, I'm only talking about one-dimensional case. Right? The principle applies to three-dimension, but the three-dimension, it's not, you have to look at all directions.
So the poly exclusion applies to all three directions in three-dimensional?
Every wave function. Okay, when you do a three dimension, your wave function will be kx determined by kx, ky, kz. Okay, each direction you have, this allowable values, and then you also plus the spin. Yes?
By your argument, does it mean metals could have only odd number of electrons? Each metal atom can possibly have
only
odd number of electrons.
No, you have to. This is one dimension. Again, the case is for one dimension. One dimension, and when you get to three dimension, you see that you have to make that combination, and also the shape is not the same in each direction. So if you look at the book, you will see, oh, those are very messy bands. Yeah, it's not a parabolic light one that I'm drawing here. Take a look at the, what is the number? Figure 317 on page
99.
Okay? It's very messy because in each different direction, that curve may be different. Let me move. I do want to discuss those cases. But I want to give you, you use one dimension as your springboard to understand it. Yes?
you said when an electron would like to move, mm-hmm. it has to change energy state.
Yeah.
But in quantum mechanics, I'm trying to think this in quantum mechanics, like free electron.
Yeah.
It can move, but it doesn't change state.
Well, it does have to change state. It does have to change state. It's just because here we see it's quasi-continuous. So very often we just forget about these granular wave vectors. Those are still discrete states. It's just so many, right? 10 to the 23rd numbers. Remember, that's order of magnitude. So those curves are essentially quasi-continuous. So that's but it does change this state. So that's what I say. When you have a few states left here, once electron going from here to here, you got a few empty states left, and thus electron in this region in the original one can move. But which one to move is also interesting question. If you say, well, the electron here, from here to here, is a big distance. Energy depends on absolute value from here to here, energy E, right? Because that E have to compare to KT. So most likely it's only those region, electron to the top level, those electrons are movable. Same in metal, although you have N electrons and only the electrons in this region. Not every electron will contribute to the electric conduction in metal. And not every free electron contributes to conduction. So if you say every metal has one electron, it's not that any electron actually contribute to electric conduction. There's only a small fraction of electron that actually contribute to electric conduction. Because of this. Yes?
Energy
cannot be, that energy is a relative.
Relative to
what? Good question.
So in this picture, K cannot be zero, right?
Because yes. I don't know what's the absolute reference there. I think when you count the absolute reference, the best to count is from the vacuum level. How much down is just like when we count the hydrogen. Hydrogen atom there is minus 13.6 electron volts below the vacuum level. That's the best reference.
So that's E minus E reference.
Yeah. But in transport later, say we often take a relative energy level. Okay. So let me continue here. So a pure semiconductor could be just a good insulator, in fact, depends on the gap. The problem is often you cannot make a pure semiconductor. You always have impurity inside. Okay? And of course, when we make the device, we artificially add the impurities. And so when you add the impurity, okay. So, for example, if you add a phosphor into silicon, okay, a phosphor has 5 electrons, silicon has 4 electrons. So what happens, it turns out that phosphor energy level is close to here, close to the conduction band edge. And that difference is comparable, smaller than KT. So what happens is that extra electron in phosphor, that extra electron is easily pumped into the upper conduction band. So now with the addition of phosphor, depends on how many atoms phosphor you add, you can get more electrons than you get in the original one. Okay? So in that case, you get a N-type semiconductor. Yes?
I want to make sure, did you mention the 4 or 5 electrons, free electrons or total electrons?
This is the outer shell of the electron of phosphor.
So when you draw this kind of thing, is that outer electron only?
Well, you asked a very good question I didn't go into. So the other way is, so here when we derive these bands, I started with the chronic and panning model. And that model is more, I say, you started with a single quantum well. And that quantum well, you have first energy level, second energy level, and each band is split of the first or second energy level into that band. And this one, the energy is proportional to n squared. I can also start from the atomic energy level, like hydrogen. This hydrogen atom, the first energy level is -13.6 eV. A second energy level is 1 over n squared proportional. So it becomes closer and closer, right? So this is an isolated atom. When I bring many atoms together, it's again, those bands began to split and forming that continuous band. So some of the those bands actually, they, for example, phosphor, the inner core atoms, although my solution will tell me this kind of band solution, but it's all full, it's all filled up. So a lot of times you have all those bands filled up. That's the electron in the inner shell. And then it's only filled here. Okay, this is where you start come. Oh, that's my Fermi level. You fill up the electron to all the bands. It depends on how many electrons each atom has. Do I answer your question? So so this is a n-type semiconductor. And then valence band. So in the valence band, it's this electron all filled up. And there are few empty states, because now the electron moved from here to here. And turns out to describe the motion of those electrons, the rest of the electron in the band. So if you have just a lattice, and what in reality, what happens is those lot of electrons, because in the valence band, a lot of electrons moving in one direction. That means whenever they move, they left, if an electron going here, they left the empty states behind. So easier way to describe those lot of electrons is actually make the reverse. Just to say that empty states, which is not the two particles, it's just those empty states, we say those are the holes. Those are positive electrons. There's no positive electron, okay? It's just a simple way make life easier, and saying that, okay, so this is electron energy increasing, and when I describe conduction band, rather than saying this is the topmost level, I say this is the bottom level of holes. So the hole energy increase in this direction. And those holes carry positive charge, E. Okay? So with this whole concept, I just say now there are a few empty states. Those states are holes. There are many holes. This is the number of holes in that valence band. It's again, that's not a true particle. It's just a mathematical convenience for describing all the rest of the electrons in that band. Okay? And now, so I have... this is how I form an N-type semiconductor. And rather than if I do not use phosphor, I use boron. Boron has 3 electrons, right? And 3 electrons. And it turns out the boron energy level is close to the valence band in silicon. So what happens? Boron has 3 electrons. Silicon is 4 electrons. 4 electrons is the most stable, right? So this is a silicon form a bond with other silicons. I'll talk more on this bonding. And four electrons, so it shares with the four silicon atoms, form a stable structure. And now, when you have boron, so this one now is a boron, it only has three electrons there, not silicon. So what will happen in this case is that this free electron, because now this is a smaller than KT, free electron will be excited to boron state and trapped by the boron. So boron now has an extra electron, so it carries, the boron atom carries a negative charge. They trap one electron from the original silicon crystal. And that trap left one empty state there. So that created one hole, right? So that's you add a positive electron in mathematical covalence. Okay, so you add more holes into your semiconductor. That's your p-type semiconductor. Okay? Yes?
Don't the impurities affect the original band structure?
It can, if you dope very heavily. Okay? But if you don't dope very heavily, the original band structure is about right. So if you dope very heavily, this will actually form an impurity tail there. Okay? So you got the pure semiconductor and doped semiconductor from this simple picture there. And let me do one more. Since I've been trying to escape mathematics, now one thing that we will use to describe those electrons or holes is some approximate expression for the band structure. Okay? And this approximation is typically most of the time will say we will be dealing with, for example, this region. Because you can see if I deal with semiconductor, I deal only either the top of the bands or bottom of the bands. And this is the point where I have a symmetry, right? 2 pi, every 2 pi, I got the repeat symmetry. Symmetry means the first order, it's either maximum or a minimum. That means the first order derivative is zero, as long as that derivative exists. Right? So I can expand as an approximation. So let me approximate for this point. This one, the bottom is EC. That's the bottom of the bands. So I want to express E in the vicinity of EC, so I have E approximate, I use a Taylor expansion to approximate. As a function of the wave vector is E at K, whatever this maximum or minimum happens, so let's say maximum or minimum happens, and plus the first order derivative K minus Km plus 1/2 second order derivative K square K minus Km square, right? This is wherever this Km maximum or minimum happens, right? Taylor expansion. And as I said, because at the Km, this is the value at the K equals Km, and this is also at Km. At Km, it's either maximum or minimum, so this term is zero. Right? First order derivative is zero. So I can use, if I have conduction band, so I say this is where the EC, that's called conduction band edge, and 1/2 dK square K minus Km square. It's a parabolic shape. Right? So what I mean is I'm approximating this band using a parabola rather than the whole curve there, because I'm only most of the time interested in this small region close to the band edge. Okay, and this one could be simplified into a form that will be more familiar for us. This is h squared k minus km squared divided by 2m star. And this now, that's just a rewriting of the equation. This is the way how I define this 2m star. This is the m star from this definition. I can say it's essentially h square and dE dK second order derivative at km. Right? That's just a way of simplifying my mathematics, reading the expansion, right? But this simplification gives me E minus EC. So now I am approximating the bands wherever it happened. Let me take a KM equal to zero, because that was make my drawing all that easier. So what this is my K, and what I'm doing is expanding this band using a parabolic expansion. This is where EC happened, and this is where the E of the band, right? And so what I have here is h square k square 2m. And the reason I want to write this into this is for you to recall the free electron. What's a free electron expression for energy? A free electron, is energy equals p squared momentum divided by 2m, right? Momentum divided by 2m, momentum according to the Planck-Einstein relation is h bar squared k squared divided by 2m. What I have here, that expansion is very similar to free electron, right? Except that I replace this mass, by this one. What is this one? This one is just a curvature mathematically. It's the curvature of this curve, right? The larger the curvature, the less is the mass. So if this one is this shape, you have a larger value of the second order derivative, you have smaller m star. If it's this curve, it's a heavier mass. So this m star is called the effective mass. And later on, when we deal with the transport, most often we'll use just those simple expressions for the energy wave vector relation. Yes?
Why wouldn't the approximation just be a sine plus a cosine, like where we calculate it?
Sine plus cosine. Yes, I suppose you can. Particularly, this is like a cosine point there. You can cosine. You can expand. If you expand using the Taylor expansion, you'll find out that it's the second order, right? You still get, if you further use the Taylor expansion, sine cosine is too complicated. Okay, take it that way. Okay, you can do your analysis. So this is the effective mass. So what this is leading to us is later on when we treat the electron transport, we'll deal with most like a free electrons with a different mass. Okay, and correspondingly, this h bar k is also called a momentum. It's called a crystal momentum. And it's not really the momentum. If you go to calculate wave function, we see the momentum for IH bar. This is the momentum operator, right? Quantum mechanics. If you do this, you will get a different momentum value. Okay, but in terms of transport, it suffices just to think this as the momentum of the electron. So this is the discussion based on that simple model. And now let me extend to 3D, because we're asking, say, two electron is an insulator. Well, three dimension is in a real crystal. Let's say we have a cubic here. Real crystal are just a periodic arrangement. So in different directions. So in this direction, I have atom with a repeating distance from is A, right? But in this direction, I also have a different repeating distance. That's a square root of 2A, right? Diagonal direction. Or from this atom to this atom is square 3A, root of 3A. So in different crystallographic direction, I have different period. And different period, you go to think about your Kronig-Penney model, you will have different solution for the electron versus wave vector in that direction. Right? So that's why you see in page 99, you see different curves in draw in different direction. So very often we say this is a one direction of the crystal. That's a pi over A. So that is typically one zero zero direction. Again, this is a crystallography I have to talk. And then we have a different direction, and it may be a different curve, because I only need to express half of it in each direction. So you can see, again, turn your page to 99, you can see in different direction the curve looks not symmetric, because I'm only, each direction only plotting half of it. Okay? And then, so what happens is, so you could say this might be, I'm just drawing quite arbitrarily, okay? Those could be the actual band structure, because it all depends on what's the potential, what's the distance in that specific direction. And now there is a situation, because it's a three dimension. So there is a situation here, maybe this is the top of my band where it fails as a semiconductor, at absolute zero. Then, say this is one gap, but here there is another, you can say the minimum gap, right? The electron does not need to come over here, it can come over here, it's easier because it's smaller energy. Gap leading, smaller energy, right? So this absolute gap in all directions, you look at the crystal, absolute minimum, that's really called the semiconductor band gap. This is really the band gap. That's the absolute minimum in all directions. That's when you consider three dimension. And sometimes you are lucky that this gap happens to be same k vector direction. Okay, this maximum versus this minimum, if they happen at the same direction, that's the case. Okay, if in all three dimensions, and this is the same k v vector, that's a direct gap semiconductor. And for example, gallium arsenide, band gap, I think, is 1.42 electron volts at room temperature. Okay? A silicon is not a direct gap. Silicon is actually indirect gap. It's the valence band maximum is here, conduction band is not at the same position. And that's a silicon is an indirect gap. And with the band gap, absolute band gap, 1.12 electron volts. Hope my memory is right. So there is a big difference. When you make an optical device, you use direct gap most of the time. Lasers, semiconductor laser, most build on direct gap. And when you use the microelectronics, we all build on silicon. So a lot of people trying to merge how you can build the optical device on silicon. And one fundamental problem is direct gap versus indirect gap. Okay. So that's the what I want to discuss about electrons. And now let me move on to the other topic of energy in crystals. This is the lattice energy. Here we're talking about the energy of electrons. And next I'm going to talk about the energy of lattice vibration. After that, I come back to tell you the three-dimensional crystal structure. Hopefully that will be easier. And again, when we discuss the lattice energy, we will use simple picture, one-dimensional picture, and then extend to three dimension. So this is a lattice vibration. And photons. So, and if you remember when we discussed electron, we could start with the atomic energy level, we could start with a quantum well, and same thing, when we discuss the photon or the lattice vibration in a crystal, we can start thinking about the hydrogen atom. Hydrogen molecule, I have two atoms, right? And we did not solve the Schrodinger equation. What we gave is this energy level of the hydrogen atom is quantized, h nu n plus 1 half. Well, this nu is actually a classical result. It's k divided by m. If you have a harmonic oscillator, spring mass system, that's the classical natural frequency of the vibration. And what quantum mechanics tells you is that this vibrational energy cannot be any value, must be the multiple of h nu. Right? So now I want to build from here to a one-dimensional atomic vibration. One-dimensional atoms in a chain. Okay, so this again, see from atom 1 to atom n. I'm not interested in the electron energy level in this case. I'm interested in the atomic vibration. I want to find out what are the vibrational energy levels of the atom in such atomic chain. You can actually now if you just based on our argument for electrons, you can probably make a guess. Okay? Remember, in the electron, I say I can start from here, one quantum level, quantum well, energy 1, energy 2, I form a continuous bond, split. Right? And from there, I get this is the pi over A. This is the electron energy level. Oh, I plot multiple one. And the guess for lattice vibration is there's some similarity here, because here is a discrete hydrogen molecule. So one vibrational frequency. Right? Now I got many atoms, so it turns out that this one or split into a band for photon band, the lattice vibrational band. But I can derive it. This time, let me derive it. I don't go to quantum mechanics to derive it. I just use Newtonian mechanics to show this is the frequency. And again, this is the wave vector. And this is the vibrational frequency, because energy equals H nu, so that also means this is the vibrational energy. Okay? So let's derive that shape of energy level. And again, I use my spring model, because between the atoms, when we deal with this hydrogen atom, we see the potential of the two atoms is one is attractive, the other is repulsive, and at the minimum, I can expand that using harmonic, just like I do the electron energy band expansion, I do the potential expansion, that's a parabola that gives us ideal spin, right? F equals minus kx, and potential is then 1/2 kx squared. Harmonic spring. So I do the same thing. I connect all the atoms with the spring. That means I only consider the adjacent atom interaction. I do not consider the interaction of this atom directly force interaction between this atom and this atom. You can add that complexity, but I'm doing the simplest model. So I'm only consider a chain of atoms connected by identical spring, with identical spring constant. Right? So this is atom 1, this is atom 2, let's say this is atom I, this is atom N. And I want to look at the motion of arbitrary atom, and I do classical mechanics. Why I do classical mechanics? Here I said this, you can see the frequency is a classical and the quantum mechanics just add a quantization. So what I'm going to do here is first find out the classical mechanics wise, what are the frequency of this atomic chain, and then I add the quantum mechanics back, the quantization back. So how I analyze this atom I, and with the mass m, and with the lattice constant a. Now here is the atom I, here is the atom I minus 1, here is the atom I plus 1. Right? Because I'm considering nearest labor interaction only, so the atom I, the force is only between I minus 1, I plus 1. Those are the force experience. Right? And I want to write down the equation of motion, the Newton's equation of motion for atom I. I'm going to erase board, you can write it down and tell me. Write down the Newton's equation of motion for the atom I. M equals, F equals MA, write that. What is F? What is the A? So, let me assume that x0 I is the equilibrium position. Okay? So the atom will, if it has a vibration, it moves away from the equilibrium. So I say that the U I is x I as a function of t minus x I. X0i. So that's a displacement from equilibrium. Right? This is just a small deviation from equilibrium. Okay? At the equilibrium, the force is balanced. The left and right force are balanced. And what I'm analyzing is the dynamic case when the atom vibrate. Right? So I want to write down F equal MA. So the A is mass derivative of its position, right? This is the MA. And this is the force. So the force of the atom. This one will experience a force in this direction, will also experience a force in this direction. Because this atom spring is dragged this way, this spring is dragged that other way. Right? So what are the force? If the spring constant is K, and this is xi plus 1 minus xi, that's the force in the from between this atom dragging towards the positive x direction. Right? And then minus k xi minus xi minus 1. This is the force of the other atom, this I minus 1 to the atom I. Right? Okay. So that's the Newton's law, second law for this atom. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to use my displacement, because I add the equilibrium position, but equilibrium doesn't depend on time. And at the equilibrium, this force is balanced, so I can effectively write, just replace that the absolute position by the displacement. Maybe this step is not really necessary. So my so K is the spring constant. My task is just trying to find out what are the allowable, what's the vibrational frequency from this equation. Yes?
So you're assuming the undeformed length of the spring is zero.
No, I'm assume this is an equilibrium position, so what I have is equilibrium, I plus 1, 0, should balance. So because it's equilibrium, that should be 0. Right? So the spring constant is not 0. So I need to solve this equation and find out the relationship. You can see, let me do a trick. I plus 1 plus u, I minus 1 minus 2 ui. I just do what this looks like. Final difference equation, right? This is final difference equation. So if I don't care about the discreteness, I could just write this as a dx squared times 2a, that's the lattice constant, 2a squared. A second order derivative of du dx. Right? Right? So if I do continuum mechanics, this is my corresponding equation. Oh, yeah, I missed a k. If I do continuum mechanics, right? And this is a wave equation. I probably should write the partial derivative, right? Since du dx, this should be partial du dt. Dt squared. That would be the continuum mechanics equation. And what's the solution there? It's a wave, propagating wave solution. Right? You can go to solve it, but you will get, in this case, xt is proportional to amplitude exponential minus I omega t minus kx. This k is the wave vector k. It's not the spring constant k. And you can find the relation between omega and k by substituting this back into this equation. Right? That's the continuum. If you do continuum mechanics, this is how you go to find the solution. And then you can find the relationship between omega and k, and then you'll find it's a linear relationship. Just by substituting this in, you find the linear relationship between omega and k. Okay, that you can go back and try. So my problem is I cannot do this partial derivative, because the atomic distance, this displacement cannot be infinitely small. The atom has to maintain their distance a. Okay? So I cannot do those continue, and I have to try. Probably I should not use the. I probably should not use this displacement. I should just use the absolute position x. But you can go back absolute position. Probably rather you. We can go back to this equation, and same. All the same argument apply. I have argued so far. So in this case, to find the solution, what I'm going to try is a result similar to here, but I place this x as my discrete atomic position.
That's what you did when you had x
naught. Huh? Which one?
At the very top of the find you.
Yeah.
I thought you were already doing it in terms of absolute position.
This is a relative position. This is an absolute position. Right? I should probably use the absolute position. Now I realize I don't need this displaced position. So I just put in, this is my absolute displacement. And I will have amplitude exponential mass I omega t minus kx. Now x is the absolute position, so it's a k n a. Or IA. I don't want to use I. I use J. Because I is for imaginary number. Sorry, go to change all the I into J. Okay? Didn't think about it. So this I is imaginary number, and this is atomic J. Go back to change all this subscript I into J. And so I try this solution. That solution essentially is continuum, except that now I take the position x as my atomic position. Right? So I substitute this into the equation. Let's see what we get. Substitute back into this equation. M, second order derivative with respect to time, so is ma. I omega square is minus omega square, and then exponential minus I omega t minus k j a. That's the left hand side, right? And the right hand side is I substitute back into here. What I have is a k a exponential minus I omega t is a common factor. And then exponential minus k j plus 1a plus exponential minus k of is minus is a plus k j minus 1a, and then minus exponential k 2ja. This is my equation after I substitute in. Right? So you can say A cancel, exponential minus omega T cancel, plus KJA. I have one KJA, there is extra one. There is also KJA, but there is extra minus one, and there is KJA. So KJA cancel.
There's 2A squared.
Huh? There's no 2A squared. Because I'm doing discrete equation, I'm not doing this one. Okay, this is a continuum equation. I'm considering discreteness of the atom now. Okay, so what this one will give you is a minus omega square. Do the math, you will find out this one is 4k sine k a divided by 2 square. Okay? Let me put a square this way so it doesn't... Okay. That's the math. But from this step, you can figure out that's what you have. Okay? So essentially here now, I get what I want. I get from here, omega equals 1 half k divided by m sine ka divided by 2. That's the dispersion. And I will pick up at the next lecture. So I find out the wave vector vibrational frequency, that means wave vector energy relation for lattice vibration. Okay.